We are continuing with the explanation of Prishus, or separation. And in this chapter, Ramchal tries to explain what we mean by appropriate separation. On the one hand, avoiding indulgence, and on the other hand, avoiding asceticism in terms of self-denial and self-flagellation as a way of life, which is something that other faiths have set as the highest spiritual goal. So he had said that there are things that are absolutely forbidden, and then there are regulations, precautionary things that the Chachamim commanded and instructed as called building fences, as it were, around forbidden things. And then there are kinds of personal separations which a person should invoke on oneself. And then he continues, Beim Toima, and if you will ask, Minayin lanu liyesh meisifim v'hilchem b'yisurim, what is the origin, what is the basis for increasing prohibitions on things that the Torah and the Chachamim have permitted? Isn't it to the contrary? Isn't that something wrong to do? And you might make reference to what the Chachamim said, Lodayach mash'os v'toira, isn't it enough that the Torah has forbidden things? She'atabo l'esor alecha dvorim acherim, and then you come to add on other things that are forbidden, such as in the concept of nedorim, of taking vows and oaths, and a person may take a vow, I will not eat meat for 30 days. Right? And takes an oath restricting himself from certain pleasures. So the comment of the Talmud is, what business do you have doing that? If it was if it was supposed to be forbidden, the Torah would have forbade it. And if the Torah permitted it, why do you go and take an oath to forbid it? It says, well, it would appear then that a person does not have the right to abstain from things that are permissible. Furthermore, V'arei ma'sherol chachamein ezal b'chachmosom, she'tzorech la'esor, those things that the chachamim, that our sages realized, required a extra prohibition beyond what the Torah prohibited, the lasas mishmeres, in order to be a precautionary measure, kvar osu, then they've taken care of that already. Right? So if the Chachamim have already set up all necessary precautionary laws, umashi hinichal daheter, and things that they did not forbid and they allowed one to use, because they felt that this was appropriate to be permissible. Right? And with what right do we then come and put upon ourselves additional separations and say, no, even though the Chachamim, the Torah says this is permissible, and the Chachamim saw no reason to make this, to restrict this. If so, with what right does a person come and add on new restrictions? If you're going to take that approach of self-denial, where are you going to stop? A person will be isolated, desolate, and he will not allow himself to benefit at all from this world. And if that's so, the Chachamenu Amru, the Chachamim have said, a person is going to be held liable and culpable, on things that he saw that were earthly pleasures, and he did not want to benefit from them. Even though it was permissible and he was allowed to have them. They base this on a statement in Kehelet, in Ecclesiastes, that Shlomo HaMelech says, I did not deny myself anything that my eyes saw that was permissible. Well, if that's the attitude, right, then we stay with the letter of the law, what the Chachamim, the Torah restricted, and then what the Chachamim had on as precautionary measures. But then, one does not have to deny himself anything. Now, this approach, if we were going to stop at this point, then we would perfectly well justify everything that's going on in the religious world today. Because you walk into any store that markets kosher products, and you can see there that everything is permissible. And I remember when I was a child, there were two kinds of wine. There was the regular sweet wine that a lot of people drank. And then there was, for those who were not permitted to use sugar, the diabetics, there was dry wine. So there were two kinds of wine, sweet and dry. Now you walk into a store that sells wine, and you don't know where to look at first. Because every possible variety of wine that is present in the non-Jewish market is now present with a hechsher. You look at the dairy counter, and every possible variety of cheese that has come out in the non-Jewish world, let it be out for 4 weeks, and you have it available with Chalav Yisrael. The Ramban says that a person should not indulge in everything just because it's permitted. And the question is, if that is so, then looking at what's available in kosher, what is it that's not permitted except for ham? And you can even get artificial bacon now with a hechsher. So, what is it that's not permitted if everything is going to be, because it's permissible, right, then we have to have it. Now, if you would stop here so far with what the Mesillas Yerushalayim has said until now, right, there would appear to be nothing wrong with that. And I guess some people have only read Mesillas Yerushalayim until this point, and then somehow they didn't go on, so this is what they remained with, right, which is the problem of sometimes taking things out of context or being incomplete. So he says, yes.
How do you reconcile this pasuk from Kehelas with Lozusu Acharei Levavah?
So we've got to get there. Question is, how do we recognize this with "Do not go astray after what you see"? So we'll see what he says. Hachuvahi, the answer to this, ki haprishus vadai tzorich umuchoch. Abstention and separation from that which is permissible is essential and necessary and has its time. V'hisiru olav chachomeinu zal, as the chachomim have said, that this is mashenema, that this is what the Torah means, kedoshim to you, you shall be holy, and they explain this as meaning perushim to you, that you should separate yourself at times even from that which is permissible. Oidamru. Furthermore, they said, Kala Yosha Betainis Nikra Kodesh, a person who accepts a fast day, other than those that are prescribed by law, is considered a holy person, a saintly person. Kalvachayma Minozil, more so than a Nozil, who the Torah considers a holy person, who just denied himself wine for 30 days, right? And if a person who denies himself only the enjoyment of wine is considered saintly, then a person who fasts entirely and deprives himself of all food and drink is certainly considered saintly. And yet, there is also, as he will indicate, the Torah also says that a nozir must bring a sacrifice, right, for having denied himself wine. Right? Now, which way is it? Is he a saint or is he a sinner? Furthermore, it says, Tzadik oichal l'soivan avshay. A righteous person, a tzaddik, eats only to satisfy what his soul needs. And the Chachamim say, Zechizkiyah Melech Yehuda, this refers to Chizkiyah, the king of Judah, Amru Olav, about whom they said, Sheshtei Agudat Shal Yerek V'litri Shal Bosra Hoya Maila Lefonu B'chol Yoy, that they brought his daily diet, consisted of two bunches of vegetables and a litra, which is a small amount of meat. Right. And that was the royal diet. And the Israelites used to mock and ridicule him, saying, Ze melech, right? This is a king. Kings should have gourmet delicacies served on his table every day and not get along with just a meager amount necessary for his survival. Oy damru. They also said, Rabbeinu HaKadosh and Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, one who put together, compiled the Mishnah, who was an extremely wealthy person, Shabishas Misosoi, that shortly before his death, Zokav Eser Atzpoisov, he put up his hands and showed his 10 fingers, the Omer, and he said, Golav Yadu Lefanecho, he said, testified before God, Shaloi Nehenesi Min Oilam Azeh, that I did not take personal pleasure from this world, afilu be'etzpa ktana sheli, even as much as the size of my little finger. And furthermore, they said, while a person is praying fervently, that he absorb Torah into himself, he should also pray, that he should not totally be absorbent in food and drink. Now, you have there two sets of statements by the Talmud that seem to be irreconcilable, that seem to be contradictory. You know that there are many such sets of statements. And the Rebbe of Ropshitz said that before his neshama came down, before his soul came down to this earth, he was looking at two walls in Gan Eden. On one wall it was written, a person must be extremely humble. And on the other wall it was written, every person is obligated to say, the world was created only for me. He said, how can I reconcile these two? On the one wall he saw something like the Ramchal just quoted, that a person will be held liable for everything that he saw and did not partake of. Right? And on the other wall he saw that a person who fasts and deprives himself of food and drink is considered a saint. This is how I can reconcile it. When he went on listing all these sets of contradictory statements, and he says, and I was trying, racking my brain to try to reconcile the two, and all of a sudden I heard everybody saying, Mazel Tov, it's a boy. And he said, so he came down to this world without having reconciled the two, and he said he spent his life trying to reconcile these two sets of opposites. So, Ramchal says, all of the statements that we've just quoted, Moirim Beferush, clearly indicate Tzorech HaPrishus V'Hachoivaboy, that there is a need for a person to abstain. Right? Omnam, and yet, I'll call upon him, at any rate, Tzrichim Ono L'Taretz, we have to be able to explain HaMamorim HaMoirim Hefach, the other statements that we quoted, that indicate the opposite. Acha Inyan, the truth of the matter is, Kivada Chilukim Rabim Ve'ikrim Yesh Bedova. There are principles and there are differences in a time when one set of rules apply and another set of rules apply. And the object of being a good and just and righteous person is to know when. There is no such thing as something which does not have its proper time and place. It's just a question of knowing when and when not. And some things that can be absolutely wrong at one time are appropriate at another. And that's really the entire secret of being a proper person, is to know when and when not. And Shlomo HaMelech says this in one chapter. He goes on and lists a number of things by Kol Yesh Zman. For everything there is an appropriate time. And he lists a bunch of opposites. There's time to cry and there's time to rejoice and there's time to build and there's time to dismantle. And the only problem is that people do things at their whim without thinking, giving consideration as to, is this the proper time or isn't it? Yesh priso shenitztavino boy, there are kinds of separations from indulgence that we have been instructed to adopt. V'yesh prisha she'ishanu olav levilti koshalma. And there are times when one can separate oneself from that which is permissible, and it is wrong to do so. V'humah she'om ha'shleimah melech olav ha'shalom, ha'shleimah melech says, al tehi tzadik halbe. Do not be too great of a tzadik. If you go to an extreme, you might end up thinking that you're going to be a great tzaddik, and actually it'll end up in being just the opposite. I mean, clearly some person has to use judgment. My best example is with Pesach. There is a clear prohibition on having any chametz in your house on Pesach. So we clean diligently. Certainly, eating a tiniest crumb of chametz is forbidden. Therefore, the kitchen and the areas where one eats has to have the greatest amount of effort to make sure that one is rid of all chametz. People have different attitudes as to how soon do you get the chametz out of the house before Pesach. In many homes, it is a custom to clean the whole house out and yet leave enough chametz to eat until the prescribed time on Erev Pesach, whether it's 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, and to that time you eat chametz, and from there on you don't. Other people who feel uncomfortable doing that may not allow chametz into the house for several days earlier. They may have made set themselves a designated place, someplace in the basement or someplace in the garage or wherever, where to eat chametz till the morning of Pesach. And I can understand that, you know, you only have one kitchen, and in that kitchen you have to prepare your Pesach food, right? And you just don't feel comfortable having chametz in there, anywhere near there, while you're having the Pesach utensils out and preparing food for Pesach. And I understand that. Some people go further than that. And maybe for a couple of weeks before Pesach, they are very careful not to bring chametz in the house. After all, they're in the process of bringing the dishes up and down from the basement of the attic or whatever. You know, and they just don't. I can understand that. And at some point, a person can lose control of that, as happened with one woman that I know of, who eventually got to the point where she did not allow chametz in her house all year round. And poor husband, who wanted to eat bread, had to eat bread in the garage. Right. Had to have a sandwich at work, but she refused to allow chametz in the house. Now, somebody might look at her and think, oh, she is an extremely saintly person. She is so cautious about not having chametz in the house, right, that she is taking the utmost precaution. Right. Clearly that is not what Hashem desired. No one, by the farthest stretch of the imagination, is going to say that this is piety. It's clearly some kind of neurosis. Right? And neurosis is not piety. And Shlomo HaMelech says, Al tehi tzadik halbe, don't overdo being a tzadik. The Rav Shetzarov used to be very intolerant of people who set up their own standards of what observance is. And he used to say, the Talmud says that a person who says Ashrei, the chapter of Tehillim that we say in the morning and the evening, and we say it three times, twice by Shachas and once at Mincha. So the Talmud says that a person who fulfills this obligation and says Ashrei three times a day, right, is assured of a place in the world to come. So the Rav Shetzer says, and what is a person who says Ashrei four times a day? Right? He said, he's a fool. Because if it was supposed to be said four times a day, the Chachamim would have said four times. Right? If the Chachamim said you're supposed to say it three times a day, don't try and be better and say it four times. Right? Don't try and be holier than what the Chachamim have told you to be. So that's the concept of Al Tehi Tzadik Halbe. So this now requires us to define what is the healthy, desired degree of abstinence, and what is the kind that is considered unwise and improper. The Noima, we will say, Achar sheiz ba'alonu, once it has been explained, he yois kolin yoni oilam nishyonis la'adam, that all of the things that are pleasurable in the world can serve as temptations as to whether a person will transgress or not. As we have proven before, that a person is subject to abundant temptations. We've also come to realize, gamkein, how vulnerable a person is to fall into the trap of doing something which is improper and being misled by his cravings and desires. And furthermore, that not only is a person misled by his desires, but a strong urge and a strong desire can lead a person to think that this, that something which is forbidden is permissible. Right? Just like the Torah says that a judge who accepts a bribe is going to issue a wrong judgment because he's going to be, his judgment is going to be distorted and he will not be able to see truth from falsehood. Similarly, a person who has a strong desire to do something can easily be misled into justifying it and giving himself all kinds of rationalizations and trying to convince himself why something which is forbidden is really not so. Okay. So there are abundant temptations, and we are extremely vulnerable, not necessarily to willfully transgress, but to mistakenly think that what is forbidden is not. Yizborer behechtat, so you must come then to conclusion, shekol ma sheyuchal ha'odom limolet minyonim mo'ela, that every precaution that a person can take to avoid being misled into doing the kinds of things that he has cravings for, right? And in order to avoid making improper judgments because of being bribed by the temptation, then it's appropriate that he takes such steps, in order to be protected to the utmost from doing the kinds of wrong things that cravings and temptations can lead you to. There is no such thing as a physical desire that might not bring along with it an actual transgression. Every physical desire is capable of being overstepped, and a person is susceptible to doing kinds of things that are forbidden as a result of temptation. So this then is the basis for taking proper steps to avoid temptation. And this may vary with each individual. And a person has to be a maven on oneself. A person has to know what his vulnerabilities are. Someone who does not have an allergy to ragweed does not have to try to avoid ragweed during the hay fever season. A person who does have that vulnerability will only use common sense in order to try to avoid exposure to something which is going to cause him misery. Right. So, aren't the two individuals equal? Yeah, but they have different susceptibilities and different vulnerabilities. And a person has to know what is my sensitivities and what is my vulnerabilities. And I may have to take certain steps to protect myself that another person does not have to do. Okay. We'll continue tomorrow. We're continuing now the discussion of how does one distinguish between abstaining from things for good reasons, and this is good self-restraint and appropriate denial of permissible things, and from the kind of self-denial and self-flagellation that is considered unwise. And so he began yesterday by saying, we began yesterday by saying that inasmuch as a person is subject to temptation, and every temptation has within it the possibility of misleading someone. Therefore, a person must take proper precautions to protect himself against being misled by temptation into doing wrong things. Derech Moshel, for example, Hamachal v'hamishta, food and drink, kishenikol mikol isurei achila, if they are free of any forbidden food, any forbidden ingredients, hinim lutovim he, they are permissible. So everything has got a hechsher. It's glad kosher and chol of Yisrael and everything else. So these are certainly permissible. Omnom, yet, miloi hakoresh, if someone indulges and is a glutton in eating or drinking, moishach achav prikas oil, that can lead to throwing off the sense of responsibility toward Hashem. Umishte hayayin, an indulgence in intoxicating drinks, indulgence in wine, moishach achav hazanus l'shel dvorim roi, that can lead to a loss of self-control, to immorality, and to doing things that a person would not do if he had proper controls. Now, there's nothing wrong as far as the drinking kosher wine is concerned. It's not a transgression. It's permissible. He says, but if you overdo it and you lose your sense of propriety, a person will do things that he would otherwise not do. Indulgence in food, simply for the pleasure of eating a food, can lead to deterioration in habits. If only, take the extreme example, the Roman orgies, right? Where people gorge themselves to the gills and later on force themselves to throw up so that they could sit down and eat again. Now, is there anything technically wrong with that? They didn't eat anything trade. No, there's not anything trace in there, but it certainly is improper. So he says, look, you cannot say just because something is permissible, therefore it's advisable. And there are hungers and appetites and whatever that you have to be careful about that they don't mislead you. Koshkin, certainly. If a person makes it his habit that he must have food or drink, not talking about food or drink in order to survive, but delicacies and abundant drink, and this becomes a necessity for him, as we see in eating disorders that are addictive, or in alcoholism, right, which is addictive. And these become not only the kinds of things that a person uses reasonably and judiciously, but they become things on which he becomes totally dependent. If he will at any time lack what he has gotten accustomed to, then he'll be terribly distressed by it. He will very much aware of his lack. This will lead him to put himself into a greater effort to attain the means in order to get that which he needs. And in order to acquire more and more money so that he can have the kinds of things that have become necessities for him. So that he could have all that he desires. And this is not only talking about food and drink, but he's talking about anything that a person becomes accustomed to. A person develops a standard of living, of things that he likes to do, and these, instead of becoming being luxuries, now become necessities. And because they become necessities, he will exert himself to the utmost to be able to afford these, quote, necessities, unquote.
In certain segments of society, don't you need people who have those type of desires. I mean, because in terms of developing medical breakthroughs, having people who are devoted totally to the defense of your country, those type of, I mean, you need those people because those are types of people that are going to be in the Army. Those are people who are going to make the breakthroughs. So how do you balance that?
The kinds of examples that you've given do not sound like indulgences. There are people who are either idealistic or ambitious, and these are not the kinds of things that are likely to cause a person to behave improperly. What he is saying over here is that if you set yourself a standard of living, that things that are not essential have become essentials, he says, then you're going to eventually drive yourself to get those, quote, essentials, and you'll have little time for Torah, little time for other actual important things in life, because you're completely devoted toward getting the things that. So, if all you need is a vehicle to get you from one place to another, and a car is a necessity, as it may be, that's one thing. If a luxury car now becomes a necessity, then a person will do everything within reason or beyond reason to get himself what has now become a necessity for him. And I have seen people for whom luxuries have become absolute necessities. And not only are they capable of exerting themselves totally in order to get what they feel is now a necessity for them, but as he goes on, if that is not enough, umisham nimshach el ovel v'agozel, they can then be led by their temptations and by their quote needs for their essentials to do the kinds of things that are actually improper and in violation of ethics and morals and law.
So as long as you don't transgress any laws, like, you know, some people may do something illegally doing this research to try to push along,
even though
it hasn't been approved or something like that.
No, I don't think that research is in the same category. Okay. I think research is in the category of advancing of knowledge, of doing things that will benefit other people. And sure, there may be some ego involved in it, and even that needs to be monitored. But
you can see where that's been taken to extremes too. People have faked results in research in order to get some kind of fame, and they've been proven that they faked.
You can go all the way to beyond that of some of the abominations that happened in the Holocaust, with Mengele doing scientific experiments and torturing human beings. Everything has its absurdities, but he's talking about the more common kinds of things that are likely to happen when a person develops a standard of living. And for example, in Les Miserables, Jean Valjean stole bread. Now, we're not going to justify stealing at any time, right? But I suppose by some stretch of the imagination, a person could understand that if the individual was starving and didn't have anything to eat and stole a loaf of bread, one can at least rationalize as to why he does it, right? But it's possible for an individual to set up a kind of standard of living where luxuries become a loaf of bread. And he can no more do without these luxuries, which now have become necessities for him, than a starving person can do without a loaf of bread. And in fact, it may sometimes be that inasmuch as hunger is a physical appetite, and it's possible for an individual to deny himself food for a period of time, it may even be worse when the appetite is an ego appetite. Because there are people who may not be able to deny themselves their ego drives, whereas they could abstain from food even at the point of hunger. So setting oneself a kind of standard of living that is far beyond what is actually necessary for survival, and he says his point here is, He has no problem with a person enjoying the goods of life. He says, the question is, has it become an essential for you? I had an individual many years ago whose wife was concerned that he may have an alcohol problem. And he said to me, "Doctor, this is the greatest absurdity I've ever heard of. I will admit that when we go for vacation and I have a free weekend," he says, "perhaps I drink more than I should. That can occur twice or three times a year." And maybe, he says, "maybe that's not the wisest thing to do, but I'm certainly not alcoholic." And I said, "Well, tell me how you use alcohol the rest of the year." And he says, I don't drink every day. And when I do, it's not to excess. He says, "I never drink during the daytime. In fact, there's one exception," he said. This gentleman was vice president of a major bank chain. And he said, "I have 27 bank managers that are answerable to me. And every Wednesday, we have a meeting of all the bank managers. Now, before going to that meeting, I always take a drink." I said, "Why?" He says, "Because I'm just too rigid, I'm just too uptight, and take a drink, it relaxes me, and I can conduct that meeting better." And I said, "You know, Bill, I'm not concerned about your two or three weekends a year. What I'm concerned about is the fact that you drink every Wednesday before a meeting." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because my definition of alcoholism, one of the definitions is, if any normal behavior becomes dependent on alcohol." Now, I'm not talking about how much, and I'm not talking about how frequently. But if normal behavior becomes dependent upon alcohol, that is alcoholism. Maybe it's early alcoholism, right? But that's alcoholism. I said, "Look, for you to conduct a business meeting every Wednesday, that is normal. And if that has become dependent on alcohol, right, then you have an alcohol problem. You're an alcoholic." Well, he denied it. And it took him 5 years to find out I was right. And the reason for that is quite simple. If something is normal behavior, then you're not going to be able to do without it. For him, this was his occupation, this was his normal thing, right? One of the things that we know about alcohol, as well as about food when it's used addictively, or anything that is used addictively, is that it rarely remains stationary. An individual who relies on alcohol to get rid of tension is sooner or later going to find out, this is a matter of weeks or months and varies with people, that the phenomenon of tolerance occurs, which means that the same amount is no longer going to cause the same effect. Right? So what Bill found is that the drink that he took gave him enough relaxation that he could conduct the meeting. Over a period of time, that drink lost its potency. The body became immune to it. It didn't do anything. Right? So he's right back to square one. Right? Now he's uptight, even with the drink. There was only one solution to that. Two drinks. And it's only a matter of time before the body develops an immunity to two drinks. Now, the only option is either cut out the normal behavior or tolerate the tension, right? Or increase the amount of chemical. Right? Now, he couldn't give up the normal behavior because that was his livelihood. Right? He could not do it with tension. Right? Therefore, he had to increase the dose. So, this is true of any addictive behavior. An individual is, in fact, that's a characteristic of addictive behavior, that the substance or the action loses its potency, and if a person has become dependent on it, he just needs more of the same, until it eventually leads to absurd proportions and to gross negative effects, which is what happens with Bill, who became very severe overt alcoholic over a period of 5 years. And this is what he's saying over here. He says, "I've got no problem with a person enjoying the world. Right? Question: the problem I have is if it becomes a regilus, if it becomes habitual. Because if it becomes habitual, then you may not be able to do without it. And if you're not able to do without it, and you've become dependent on indulgence, then it's only a question of time. Number one, before it increases. And secondly, before you begin doing the kind of things that you must do for a necessity." Right? And people will steal for a luxury car, just like Chavo John stole bread, because he felt his survival was at stake.
Sometimes it becomes socially acceptable. Like people had to drink before they got on airplanes. Now, there's plenty of opportunity to buy a drink at the airport. If you got on the airplane, they come around, they pour more for you again. Listen.
An individual who...
And why an airplane should be any different than anything?
Right. An individual who flies regularly and cannot fly without having a chemical, right, is leaving himself open to addiction, a high risk of addiction. And that's true of anything. An individual who wants to take a drink before eating, right? No problem. If he wants to make a legitimate l'chaim before eating. An individual who cannot eat without a drink first, right, has an early addiction problem. Right? And that's true if an individual says, I'm all thumbs and I can't socialize unless I have a drink first. Right? That individual already has a problem, either to isolate himself, right, or to leave himself open to the fact that sooner or later that same amount of alcohol is not going to go. An individual says, I can't possibly go to sleep unless I have a beer before sleep. Right? That's how it begins. Now, either he's going to have to give up sleep, which he cannot do, right, or leave himself open to the fact that he's gradually going to need more and more. And this is what he's talking about, where the fine distinction is between enjoying goods of this world or becoming dependent upon them. And if an individual allows himself to become dependent upon them, right, then he leaves himself open to improper behavior. Let me give an example. And it may be, I don't think it's an absurd example either. I spend my entire work day working with people who are addicted. I have had many health professionals who have become seriously addicted because they have easy access to drugs. Right? Doctors, nurses, you know, they have easy access. I have seen that once an individual becomes dependent on a drug, he totally loses his judgment. This may be a bright person, a board-certified physician, internist, surgeon, psychiatrist, whatever, but they totally lose their judgment. Right? Now, I have been a back pain sufferer for years, and sometimes the back pain really gets bad. The kind of thing that aspirin or Tylenol or ibuprofen will not help. And there is a significant temptation to get something stronger to give me relief for several days. Right? I've never done it. I've avoided it, and I've tolerated the pain. And the reason being, I have seen people who have access to drugs and who don't need a doctor to prescribe it for them, become dependent on drugs and not realize it. And they'll start off taking a Percocet 3 times a day just to alleviate their pain. And for some strange reason, the pain seems to persist. Right? So that at the end of 2 weeks, they're still taking 3 tablets a day. But now the 3 tablets a day aren't working as well anymore. So sometimes they have to slip in a 4th, right? And then a 5th. Right? And I have these people coming in with serious addictions that threaten not only their livelihood, but threaten their entire existence, entire survival. So what I've done is what he suggests to do. If you see yourself as vulnerable to a particular pattern that could be destructive, he says your only defense is take an extra precaution and don't begin with it. Now, some people will say it's foolish to suffer pain when you could use medication for 3 days. I say, yeah, but I see myself in a vulnerable position. I've seen what it's done to other people who have had easy access to it and did not realize what was happening to them. And I've seen their occupations and their careers go up in smoke.
So this comes back to free choice that Hashem has given us.
Yeah, we have free choice. The problem is if we put ourselves into a state of habit, we forfeit our free choice.
Would you draw a distinction between someone who has to take a cup of coffee in the morning before he functions? I mean, you're going to wake up regardless.
All right. I would draw the distinction, but it's a highly relative one. because I've seen people who need a cup or two of coffee and can't function without it, right? But I've also seen people who do not suffice with one or two cups of coffee, and whether they have this genetic propensity to addiction or for whatever other reason is, they end up with 14, 16 cups a day. Right? I had an individual who was actually at the verge of suicide because he had lost the ability to function. He was a student who said, look, I'm not bright. I need to put my time into study. I get sleepy very easily, and so I began to rely on caffeine to keep me awake. Well, this just increased to the point that when he came to treatment, he was taking 52 cups of coffee a day. Right? Was totally wound up, could not sleep, realized that he was in a terrible addiction, tried to cut back, but the symptoms of cutting back on the coffee were caffeine withdrawal. May seem like a comic kind of thing. It is that, right? The headache and the depression that one can get from caffeine withdrawal can be quite severe. Right? Well, you can get the shakes with caffeine, you can get the shakes from caffeine withdrawal. So here's an extreme example of an individual who had gone to an absurd amount of caffeine. Now, where do you draw the line? Draw the line that one or two cups are acceptable, possibly three for somebody, possibly. Now, obviously there's no sharp line to draw and say three yes, four no, four yes, five no. But even with something as, quote, innocent as caffeine, one must be careful. Now, what one must, where there's nothing innocent about it is with cigarettes. Okay? And cigarettes is probably the worst addiction, kills more people than all other drugs combined. Right? And yet people foolishly begin smoking and knowingly go into an addictive disease. Now, there are some very fine halakhic authorities who have said that inasmuch as we now have information that previous generations did not have, and we now know that smoking is toxic and destructive to the brain, to the heart, to the lungs, and to everything, that since we now have this information, and inasmuch as according to the Torah, one is not permitted to do anything harmful to himself, therefore, smoking is an absolute forbidden, prohibited thing, and there is really no difference whether one transgresses the Torah by taking something that is forbidden as treif, or lighting up a cigarette, which is forbidden because it's harmful to the body. Now, someone will say, well, what about the great people of previous generations who used to smoke quite heavily? And so, look, at that point, that knowledge was not available. Right? They even were under the impression that smoking is an aid to digestion and helps clarity of thought and whatever. With the knowledge that we now have, we know that smoking is toxic. And since it's toxic, that person is forbidden. I have sometimes gone over to a person in Shul Shabbos night after Havdalah. And these are this is an individual who Friday afternoon stashed away some cigarettes so that he would have it as soon as Shabbos is over. Right? And of course on Shabbos he wouldn't think of smoking, but the moment Shabbos is over, he runs over to his shtendel where he had stashed away his cigarettes and lights up. And I sometimes said, I don't know why you waited until now. Had you lit up during Shabbos, you would have been transgressing the same Torah, right? Because the same Torah that says that you're not allowed to violate the Shabbos by smoking also says you're not allowed to violate your body by doing something harmful to it. Right? And when you're lighting up now, you're violating a Torah injunction. Now, if you were so careful as not to smoke on Shabbos because the Torah forbids it, then you shouldn't smoke after Shabbos because the Torah forbids it also. And I simply have no sympathy at all for the practice of smoking. And I think that young people who think that it's a joke or wise or whatever to smoke on Purim, right? And you see little kids, 9 or 10, going around smoking on Purim, If I were in a position of authority, I would absolutely forbid any kind of that. That's not the kind of thing that you play around with, right? Or that makes you look adult, or that makes you look grown up. All that does is it sets a pattern for a very harmful practice. So what he is saying, again, is that the kinds of things that a person will allow to become habitual, even though they are technically permissible, they can lead to all kinds of unacceptable behavior, and this is why a person may have to draw the line about abstaining from things that are permissible. To be continued.